And here we are. Welcome back to another show of Common Ground. And Sherry, a recap on last Saturday, a special show we had. The Log Cabin Republicans come in this studio. Very interesting show to see if they were going to be allowed to be at the Republican, the state Republican convention. And we have over almost 8,000 views on that show. I think it might have affected their vote too, because they ended up postponing the vote and tabled it indefinitely. So, from what I heard, there were a lot of people that listened to the show and did comment to their SREC representatives. So hopefully it'll be good. I just want to say before we get started with this great show today with HD 66, the Democrat primary candidates are here in the House, and we thank you, Amy Garza Lopez and Sharon Hirsch, for being here. Just want to say a quick response to what we're getting.
I need to get the yellow card ready?
Yeah, get the yellow card ready. So basically, some candidates that we reached out to are not coming on our show because their handlers, their campaign managers, don't think that it's going to be beneficial to them. And shame on them. I think anybody in our audience, whether it be Democrat, Republican, I'm sure you want to hear from all the candidates and hear about what they're all about rather than going to these forums with 125 people and hearing the same canned questions. Here, at least on our show, we moderate and let our audience, we discuss, you decide on, you know, the essence of the candidates and what they have to say, and then you can decide for yourself, you know, what you want to do. And that's what we bring to the table. So hopefully those candidates out there that are afraid to come on our show because, we have an agenda, Sherry.
I was wondering if you're going to throw out the A word.
I had to.
Cracks me up. People aren't going to learn.
They aren't, especially challengers. I just don't understand why a challenger wouldn't come on the show because their name recognition's even less than the incumbent. So what do you got to lose?
Well, we've been accused of having an agenda since we started the very first show.
That's
back
true.
Then. I say go watch the shows.
Exactly.
By the way, my phone number's on our website. Feel free.
Yeah, call us if you have some concerns that will make you look bad on our show before you come on. But we do have some great guests coming in the future. I do want a promo. We have Alan West and James Dickey coming on the show in March. And we have a surprise congressional district race, which we're trying to finalize. That's coming on the show. And we have some judge races.
Right?
Those
will
be interesting.
Some people
have said yes. So before the primaries, should be great. So here we are. Now we're at this show. This is the important show. And I want to thank our guests for being patient while we had some major technical difficulties today. But thank you again for being here. So I'm going to give you about just a minute or so, tell our audience a little bit about you. We usually go in alphabetical order. So we're going to let Sharon go first. Tell us a little bit about yourself. And then Amy, by all means.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having us here. I'm Sharon Hirsch. I am running again for the Texas House of Representatives for District 66. My family moved here in 1996 when my husband was invited to become part of the Plano ISD family. He had worked with Dr. Delgado up in Minnesota. So this was a huge decision, and all four of our children, school-aged children, were impacted by that. So we made the decision to move down. We came and visited a few times, really liked the area, felt it was a supportive area for our children, for their education, for job opportunity. And here we are, almost 24 years later. So he ended his 40-year career in education as the associate superintendent for PISD, and I worked for 12 years in the district as a campus office manager. So having put four kids through public school, worked in the schools, both of us, legacy of service from our family and public education, I was just concerned about the state's response to schools, and that's why I decided to jump in and run against Matt Shaheen, who, you know, had not shown a lot of support for public ed.
Okay, very nice. And Amy?
All right, my name is Dr. Amy Garza Lopez. I was born in San Antonio, so that's where I grew up. My father is a retired child support investigator under the Attorney General's office, and my mother is a retired diabetic nurse educator, so they still live in San Antonio to this day. I graduated from Texas A&M University, and I went back to San Antonio for medical school. So that's where I went after my dream to be a doctor. I also completed a residency in neurology and actually a fellowship in neurophysiology, another year of training. When I was looking for jobs, I found a job in Irving, and so I saw the opportunity in North Texas, and I moved here for my first job. My fiance at the time came with me. When I was working, for another group, and I was putting in very long hours, and I had my first daughter, and I realized I didn't have the time I wanted or the flexibility, and I decided that I should probably go out on my own. So I opened my own practice in 2010 in Frisco. I started with 2 employees in a small office, and have now grown to 20 employees in 2 locations. So it's been my other baby that I've been growing over these past 10 years. But it's been good. It's been a challenge at times. A lot of businesses fail in the beginning, but we've managed to persevere and get through those economic challenges and changes. The reason that I got involved is because, you know, for me, one, the future of my children, my daughters, I see things changing in the direction that I'd like to see this country going. And, you know, I want to have a voice at the table. You know, many moms, I think, feel that way, that they don't want to be on the sidelines anymore when it comes to their children's future, opportunity, you know, education, and especially healthcare. So those are things that are important to me.
Wow, very good. And Sharon, where are you from originally? You said you moved here 25 years ago?
We moved here almost 24 years ago from Minnesota.
Okay.
Grew up in Iowa and Nebraska. My husband went to college in Minnesota, so we were high school sweethearts. So we've been married 45 years.
That's pretty cool.
Got married in Minnesota. We have family roots there. My mother was from Minnesota, so all my kids were born there, so I really adopted it as my.
So it seems like your main issue is school education, and your main issue is what? What would be your number one issue?
I would say healthcare, and then also education. And for me, you know, my parents, about 3 generations ago in Texas, you know, my grandparents went to segregated schools. They were in Marfa, Texas. And at that time, Blackwell School only went through the 8th grade. So if you were Mexican American, it was presumed you weren't going to high school.
Right.
I didn't know that. But, you know, I was very lucky that my great-grandfather worked for the Southern Pacific Railroad. He didn't work for the local ranchers or anybody on the school board. And he was able to fight for his kids to get into high school. You know, and then we fast forward a generation. My father was sent to vocational school because if you grew up on the west side of San Antonio, that's where you went to high school.
Well, getting strictly to healthcare, since that's your main issue. So you get elected, you win the primary, no offense to you, Sharon, and then you beat Matt Shaheen in the race, and you get in there, and you're the legislator, and they say, hey, Amy, we want to hear your thoughts on healthcare. What do you want to do on the state level to really make it better for our citizens? What would you say?
Well, I think we have to increase access. I mean, that's the first thing. I think most people need access to healthcare for preventative care. To keep them healthy, to prevent diseases. You know, we have one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the country, and part of that comes from not having access to preventative care and having good postpartum care. So we need to extend that time frame from current 2 months to 12 months. But the biggest thing I'm hearing is that a lot of times patients have undiagnosed hypertension or other pre-existing illnesses that are just worsened by pregnancy. And if we can treat them, we can have preconception counseling, and that can improve things. So I think that's a big issue. I think also children are being cut from services, you know, because of obstacles that are put in their way, especially the CHIP program. 50,000 kids are taken off the rolls because they have to enroll every 2 to 3 months, and that's hard for busy parents to keep up with. So even though they should be in the program, they're taken off the rolls. So there are a lot of things I think that are straightforward that we can do. My other issue is transparency.
Well, we'll get into another issue. So Sharon, how would you respond? Do you agree with Amy that those are major concerns from a healthcare level? Are those some of the things that you as well would take into consideration?
Yeah, and the couple bills with the maternal mortality and the CHIP or Medicaid, those are people with Medicaid access. That's not the general public. And those are like bills that were proposed this session and just didn't get passed. I don't even think they got out of calendars. So it's very difficult. Like 53% of women are pregnancies in Texas are paid for by Medicaid. You don't get to jump onto Medicaid till you've confirmed that you're pregnant, and then they kick you off 2 months postpartum. Wow. So the amount of time you're actually under the care of a physician is short, right? So you're not getting that great prenatal care, and you're not getting the postpartum care that obstetrics and gynecologists think you should have. So that's one thing. And with the children too, you know, parents are taking their kids to the doctor. The doctors are saying, oops, sorry, you know, you're off the rolls because of fluctuation, maybe in income. So those are a couple of the just very base things we've been doing. But, you know, we just haven't moved the ball hardly at all on healthcare since deciding not to take the Medicaid expansion. Now, I mean, my fear now is that it might not even be available to us, depending on what the Trump administration does.
Well, right. And funding also.
With Medicaid, if they turn it into a block grant.
Okay, so then let's talk about your majors. So you win the primary, and you're up against Matt Shaheen, and you win, and you're now sitting there as the legislator from the great HD 66. And they say, Ms. Hirsch, we heard that you ran on education. What do you want to do to change things, shake it up in Texas?
Well, there's still a lot that needs to be changed. And we had been underfunding and undermining the system for years. So even though this was a historically big bill, it filled in holes. It didn't really move us down the path to where we need to be. We're still, depending on which survey you look at, 42nd in investing in our kids, even with this big chunk of money, because almost half of it went to pay down property taxes. So we need to find that sustainable source of revenue to keep that moving forward. They knew they didn't have enough money to move this down the line. That's why there was an attempt to raise the sales tax, because they knew they needed additional revenue. So the biggest conversation, I think, in terms of education in the next session, because it's very short, we're going to have redistricting and all these other things, is to take a look at what that revenue stream needs to look like. And then also look at the impact of HB3, because it was very uneven. Some districts did very well and they're very happy. Others, not so well, Plano included. You didn't see big raises, 2% for a support staff, 2.5% for teachers under 6 years of experience, and 3%, you know, for six and above. Those aren't gigantic raises when you see their healthcare costs going up. So looking at the funding, looking at the impact of the bill on the different school districts, and then trying to see where you can balance some of those inequities.
That's what I was going to ask you. Do you think HB3 was enough to get started and you could just go in and tweak it, or are you saying we're going to have to go find a whole other option?
Oh, no. I mean, I think you build on what they did. It's unfortunate that it took an election. It took an election to get them to act, and my fear is, if we lose ground in the next election, they'll go right back to that push for privatization. It was a huge push for years. There's been opportunity every single session to make education a priority.
It's right.
A big part of the budget, and they've chosen to ignore it, and that was strategic intent. And, you know, we need to have people in there that are going to stand up and say, no, this is our number one priority.
And Amy, how would you react to what Sharon mentioned, and do you see that as the way that you would handle it, and what other recommendations would you make?
Well, I think, you know, there has been chronic underfunding for a long time. So even though this was a step forward, overhead, you know, like in my business, grows every year. So the cost of education is going to continue to grow. So we're going to have to plan for additional funding, over time. So, you know, it's a fix, but it's not a long-term fix. We still need to find other ways of funding it. So I've looked at kind of two additional revenue sources. There isn't going to be one revenue source that's going to take care of it. But one thing we could do is look at the gas tax, because that 25% of that goes to education. So by reforming that, that can provide additional revenue. And then there's another housing policy that I looked at, that right now there's $15.9 billion of untaxed property value in Collin County. Part of that is locked up with the 65 and over exemption, but if we can provide affordable housing for seniors that they can stabilize the rent, they won't necessarily have to worry about costs going up over time. That can unlock some of that revenue and increase property value, so that will increase funding. So these are just two ideas. They're not going to be the only solution, but I think we have to find revenue sources, and these two ideas don't increase taxes. That's the key thing about them.
And do you guys agree on these things, or do you separate in any type of philosophical or, you know, logistical way of handling these changes? I'll throw that out to either one of you.
Yeah, I just see a lot of holes in the plans, especially with both the housing for seniors. I don't know how many seniors you have to get out of their homes to see an increase in revenue. At the local level, school taxes, anything above the entitlement amount, you have to send back to the state anyway. So senior groups, AARP, Foundation on Aging, all say 75% to 80% or 85% of seniors want to stay in their home. That's what they desire, to age in place. So yes, people need to go to other places. Yes, people want to go to other places, but the majority want to stay where they are. So they're looking at programs that would maybe make some adjustments to their home to keep it safer, community-based supports for them to stay at home. So, you know, not to be talking about Amy's plans so much, but the comptroller has indicated that there are $60 billion worth of tax exemptions, carve-outs, exceptions in the existing tax code already, $60 billion a year. So if we can define the amount of money we really need to put into education, it's quite possible, you know, this isn't one single solution. There are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of exemptions that are already in the tax code, some that are outdated, some that are unfair, some where the legislature put their finger on the scale for a specific industry, and those need to be examined first before we look at any, you know, other opportunity to raise taxes.
You want to add to that a little?
Yeah, I would say, you know, independent living facilities for seniors is not really a new concept. You know, many of my patients are already doing that, you know. So it's just making the opportunity available in our communities so that they don't have to leave it, that they can stay. Because, you know, many of them are comfortable in their community. They don't want to go somewhere else. They want to stay where their grandkids are. So it's not necessarily that you have to legislate that, but you just have to make the opportunity. And legislators have a say in that by using Reagan-era tax credits. They can bring those opportunities to the community. So I think that's one side. I think it also alleviates some of the issues with taking care of seniors. So if you have a living facility like this, they have exercise rooms, they have community rooms. So this relieves depression, anxiety, social isolation. You know, many of my patients sometimes, I worry if I haven't seen them because I don't know who's checking on them. So again, it's not really a new concept. It's just really putting it where we need it and where it can help our property tax value and increase revenue for school districts.
Okay, and let's move on. You had mentioned transparency, which I had on my list as well. So why don't you tell us what you're going to do to improve transparency for the constituents so they know what's going on in Austin?
Well, actually, I was talking about healthcare.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Let's talk about
transparency. She's like, before you rudely cut me off.
Sorry, I didn't know. I thought it was just transparency.
You know, so one of the issues that I've had in my practice for my patients is they don't understand the type of insurance policies they're buying. And it's very confusing for them and for us sometimes because they have a branded insurance. It looks like you can go to anybody who takes that brand, but, you know, it has some kind of designation that they don't understand. So I helped, you know, with this legislation last year, which was HB 3338. It's something that we actually took to Matt Sheehan a couple years ago. Very simple bill to tell insurance companies that they have to label HMO and PPO plans accurately. So if you have a narrow network where you can't go to physicians outside of it, that's an HMO. You can't call that something else. So that was one thing that, you know, I'd like to see brought back because it's a bipartisan bill. It went through the House unanimously. It failed in the Senate, but it's something that we can do that'll make things clear and prevent out-of-network billing. So that was what I was talking about as far as healthcare.
And do you want to answer to that, Sharon? Is that something you'd like to do as well?
Well, if industries can't self-regulate, I guess government needs to help them regulate in terms of transparency. That to me, that should be evident that you would
it's like a gift.
Identify your product properly. And, you know, I'm not sure what the cost savings is to the individual. Knowing is always good. I mean, I've asked my physician how much a test would cost that they suggest or a medication. They can never tell.
Well, no. And nowadays you go and they're like, oh, we'll bill you later.
Right.
Well, I'm like, I want to know if I've met my deductible. And then my favorite is, at the hospital, you get charged separate for the surgeon as you do for the hospital, as you do for this, as you do for that. And it's like, ugh. I couldn't imagine being like an older person where it's just over.
Well, I think part of the problem is the insurance. Because, you know, I can't tell you, I could do the same service for both of you, and I can't tell you what it's going to cost you or you because each plan is different, each has a different deductible, you know, a different contracted rate. You know, I think NPR did a story a couple years ago about why can your vet tell you what it's going to cost but your doctor can't. And that's because there's that middle person, you know, that middle. So we've got to find ways to make it transparent so people do know what they're asked to pay. And so it's easier for us as doctors to be able to tell you what the cost is going to be as well. But I think this is simple, you know, just at least constituents will know what they're buying. Even my insurance broker try to sell us a policy that they didn't quite understand was a narrow network.
Okay. So, Cheryl, you know, you ran against Matt Shaheen last time, mm-hmm. and you almost won.
Yes,
you're very
I did.
Close. So now you're back again. So what are you really going to bring? Most people like to hear, of course, from your party, you know, that they want a Democrat, of course, but the traditional voting audience will say, okay, Sharon, and we'll get to you in a second, Amy. Why are you running? Why do you want to bring the incumbent out? What is he doing that, you know, you are going to do a lot better than mm-hmm. he's not doing? What? How do you answer to that?
Sure. I think a couple really important things is that our Collin County representatives have not been responsive to their constituents, and they don't really reflect the concerns and the values of them. We have five state reps that are far right of center, ideologically on the Republican Party side, and our community, it doesn't look like that. So they don't like that. They don't like those ideological battles. I mean, he was front and center on what they called the Mother's Day Massacre on the 85th legislative session when they took the session down because they didn't get enough attention on their three primary goals, which is private school vouchers, an abortion ban, and permitless carry of firearms. So they dug their heels in for those issues. That just doesn't reflect House District 66. I've knocked on thousands of doors, probably more than any other candidate who's run in 66, that's for sure, and talked to a lot of people, and those aren't the issues that they care about. Secondly, I have lived in this district for almost 24 years, never sat on the sidelines as a Democrat or as a citizen, so always been informed and engaged in some fashion. I've made really great relationships in the community. I'll be able to go to Austin already having those relationships built. And we will always have an open door policy. That's not something that you've seen from the constituents. There won't be blocking unless you're, you know, done talking really nasty on social media. You know, well, I think you can criticize your elected
sure.
official. There's no reason why you can't do that. I mean, you have to do it with some sense of decorum,
right?
And I think that's something that, you know, we are just lacking, you know, total sense of decorum. And I think, you know, to pledge to be open, to be honest, to admit when you make a mistake, to say I'm sorry, and to do the best that you can for your constituents.
All right, and Amy, what would you do that's different than the sitting legislator?
I think be more effective, I think, is the straight answer. I mean, we just haven't seen him really invest much into this district, but I think, and as Sharon said, there's been a lot of divisiveness as well that he's brought in that doesn't reflect this district. This district is changing. You know, we're seeing more and more people move in. We're seeing our values that are a little bit more progressive, and so we want to make sure that we're reflecting the constituents and that we are doing what's needed for this district, investing in this district and the infrastructure and the education and the healthcare needs, and not just necessarily passing legislation that, you know, it really isn't doing much for the district.
And we are saying a lot of things, but what specifically does HD 66 need for a sitting legislator for that district need to do?
Well, and that's what I was going to ask. Sharon, those three things that you were saying, mm-hmm. The incumbent has, do you think that maybe those are dear to some of the people in the district, but not priority over some other things? Or do you really think they just don't identify with that?
Oh, no, there's always going to be a constituency
right.
for those issues.
Okay.
And, you know, I've read it online. I've heard people talk about that. But fundamentally, what the community wants, why do people move here? They moved here for great schools. They moved here because we have, I know when I came, I went to the libraries. I looked at the recreation center. I made sure there were trails and parks and places for my kids to play. I wanted to be sure that I had a son with a medical issue, that medical issue could be addressed. Things that are important to families, they're not sitting around the table talking about these highly partisan, highly charged issues. It just doesn't reflect the community.
And Amy?
Yeah, I would say, you know, as they say, all politics is local, right?
Right.
You know, those are the issues that people are concerned about. How are their children being educated? How is their health being taken care of? Can they get where they need to go? You know, I think those are what concerns most people at the dinner table. Of course, you know, we want to see continued economic success and growth in our district, but I think most people worry about the day-to-day things, and that's where their quality of life needs improvement and what we can do to help them. But the bigger issues and the divisiveness, I think that just turns people off. And I think we focus on local issues, and then we can keep our constituents engaged.
Okay. So far, so good in this conversation.
Y'all both have such lovely voices.
I know. It's like, can we get a little rattling going on here? So we're going to take a break right now for our sponsors. We're taking a heartbreak. So we're graciously sponsored by Elevated Roofing, which is one of the largest and premier roofing companies in North Texas. I don't know. Have you heard of those guys at all? Mm-hmm. Haven't seen those trucks. They have a full service. So whenever you have hail or those bad situations mm-hmm. that affect your roofing,
sure.
Elevated Roofing is not one of the companies that comes knocking on your door after the hail. You know, like they're not like car salesmen. They knock on your door, hey, you got some damage? Let me check it. They're not like that. They're all on referral. So they do a really good job as far as taking care of you for what you need done. So when I did my roof, I called them, and they actually worked with the insurance company and got them to the house and looked at it, made sure that I was covered. And then they do the full service. So besides the roofing, they did my gutters, they painted, they did everything. They picked up all the nails with giant magnets off my lawn. It was kind of cool. So if anybody is in need of a roofing company in North Texas, please contact our sponsor, our premier sponsor, Elevated Roofing, who's been with us since day one at 469-200-0582. That's 469-200-0582. And I know Sherry wants to talk about Bell and Sparrows.
Bell and Sparrow is a faith-based nonprofit entity founded by women for women. Basically what they do is they find women that are struggling from, you know, previous incarceration, addiction, sex trafficking, and or abusive relationships. And they just invest in rebuilding these women emotionally and physically. So they prop them up, you know, emotionally with supporting them. And then they also teach them sustainable trades so they can then go and support themselves. They work nationally, locally, and globally. They actually have a group on the ground in Guatemala right now doing their thing. Just really amazing. These ladies are legit. A lot of charities, you know, there are a lot of show. No, these ladies grind it out. So, and I wanted to also add, they have their golf tournament coming up on April 28th. It's called Birdies for Bells. So go to their website, check them out. You know, if you don't have a place to throw some money and donate to support and a good solution for that, Bell and Sparrow is amazing. Love them. They're great.
Yeah, and their sponsorship, by the way, is paid by an anonymous donor, so none of their proceeds pay for the show, which is, they're only going to do a few more shows, Sherry.
I really like them. I follow both ladies personally on Facebook, and, like, their personal wall intertwines with their work. It's amazing.
It's really kind of cool what they do, and they really help these women and empower them, and it'll be sad to see them go, but... And our last sponsor is Brace Humanity. Embrace Humanity. I know you guys are really thrilled by this show. I can tell. So Brace Humanity is a local company here, and they make men's and women's bracelets. They're in Neiman Marcus and Nordstrom. So Valentine's Day is right here. If you go to their website, they have pretty unique bracelets.
It's a wrap bracelet. I'm a sucker.
Are you wearing yours?
I am wearing it.
She's wearing
it. Yeah. Not wearing it. I make a wish.
So that's their yacht bracelet, and it comes from English rope from the original yacht manufacturers in England. Mm-hmm. Yep. They have different colors, and they also have stingray and Napa leather. Really nice stuff. So if you're interested, mm-hmm. and they're reasonably priced, seriously. In fact, when I saw their price, I was like, really?
I know.
So, and if you buy it and you put the word common in the promo box, you get 25% off. So
it worked for me.
She bought three bracelets.
I've been wanting one, and I just wasn't doing it. And then Steve told me there's a code. I'm like, oh, now I have to do it. I get to save money too.
Absolutely.
So if you go to bracehumanity.com and you put in the word common in the promo box, you'll save 25%. So we're back. HG66. Wasn't that great?
We're back.
We're back.
Very nice.
Very quick. And you guys, this show's running really fast for me. But one of the things that I'm sure that the audience wants to know is, you know, what is the difference between both of you? I mean, you both seem very credible, and you both have good suggestions, and they're going to have to go and pick one the lever, as we used to say, right? I guess now what they draw and fill in the box. Is that what they do in Collin County, or they still get to...
They have wonderful new electronic machines. We're going to get a paper balance.
Nice.
Take a peek, make sure everything's good.
In Denton, we have to fill in the box. So
I'm not a hater of the paper balance.
You don't like the paper? Well, you do like the paper.
No, I said I do.
Oh.
Okay.
It's good to have that.
It's a good audit.
Yeah, I would say. So, Sharon, I'll start with you. I'm sure you respect Amy, but I'm sure that you think you're going to do a better job. So tell our audience why they should, lean toward you.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, Collin County has been represented by Republicans forever. And I was in the trenches. For quite a while. I've been in the trenches for quite a while. When people were not admitting they were a Democrat, they were not voting in the Democratic primary.
That's true.
When it wasn't cool, is that what you're saying, Sharon?
Yeah.
She's saying blue is cool.
Yeah. It's not about being cool. It's about being, you know,
right,
standing up for what you really believe. And if you can't stand up for what you really believe all the time, you know, I think that's a question. But I've served the party as a precinct chair, been on the state Democratic Executive Committee, worked on a couple other committees with the Collin County Democratic Party to kind of build that foundation moving forward. When I was asked to run, I did it. I worked really hard. We had no clue whether it was a winnable race. I would never say to somebody I'm running because it's winnable. Wrong motivation as far as I'm concerned. So I just feel like I've put the work in the community. I built that foundation. I built those relationships. And I think that's really important when you go on to lead.
Okay. And I think Amy, Sharon brings up some good points, and she did run last time, and she ran a hard race. And so why did you feel the necessity to challenge her in the primary?
Well, I think everybody brings different perspectives. You know, we all have different places. You know, I'm a mother, I'm a physician, I'm a small business owner. So those are the perspectives that I bring to the race, because I feel like, you know, except my children's future is important. I want to make sure that we're taking care of them, both in, you know, with education in the future, as well as opportunities for girls and healthcare. You know, we didn't pass any meaningful legislation for healthcare this last session. I feel as a doctor, you know, I can do more for my patients with really doing something that can benefit them versus just sitting face-to-face one at a time. I've been part of the Texas Medical Association. I'm a delegate for Collin County, which has been a wonderful experience, and that's part of what's inspired me. I love going and hearing the resolutions that we're going to recommend to the legislature, but my frustration has been we don't have that bigger voice. All we can say is we recommend that you consider this. And this is our position, but we don't have the actual ability to make law. And that's been the big motivator for me, to have a bigger voice for both my children and for my patients.
I want to ask about redistricting. So I read on one of y'all's websites, I'm not think it was yours, Sharon, I don't really remember, but are you both committed to an external group doing the redistricting?
Well, we won't be able to have that, because that would require, I believe, a constitutional amendment to put forward or an independent commission. So in the future, I would like to see that as an option. It's worked very well in other places, and people should be picking their representatives, and representatives not picking their people, as is the buzz statement around a redistricting commission. But in light of the fact that we aren't going to have that,
right,
we need to have maximum citizen participation to hold our elected officials accountable.
And you agree?
I agree. I don't think it should be a partisan power grab. It needs to be fair and equitable. I think our redistricting needs to represent the people equally, and it should be populations that are similar. It should be respect counties and cities. And you know, we have some districts right now that, you know, my kid must have drawn, you know, it's just all over the place. So we need to be fair. And I think, you know, as Democrats, that's one of the things that we're committed to, is being fair in the process. You know, an independent commission is something that's been done in other places. And that allows, you know, each person to have a voice. But I think in the near future, we're just going to have to be able to stand up for what we believe in, and we're going to have other people do that as well.
Yeah, bipartisanship, I think, is really important in that. We've had, you know, representatives from both parties, and I think they both agree. Because whoever's in power usually says, no, let's draw the lines this way. And then the other one, no, we want fairness. And then they get into power, and they go, no, we want it this way. So I think a bipartisan commission is probably the best way. The topic that I wanted to bring in, which we mentioned in other HD races, was term limitations. So, you know, Amy, what's your position on term limitations? Should we have them? There's good arguments on each side, but I'd like to get your opinion on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can argue both ways. I think term limits allows other people to come in to have voices. I think there's still a learning curve for, you know, most freshman legislators. It takes a few years to figure it out. So I think there has to be a balance between getting experience, but also, you know, you can't have politicians that's their whole career, you know. So I think there has to be some balance there.
Okay, and Sharon, what do you think about
that? Yeah, I don't have a hard line on term limits. This is what you hear from people when they talk about their schools, when they hear them talk about their representatives. Schools are failing, but they like their school, and they like their teachers. Or all politicians are crooked, but they continue to reelect their representative. So I think we need to have greater participation from people. If we took money out of politics, you would see people able to run that didn't have deep pockets.
So
campaign reform might help with getting out some of these entrenched people. When you limit the kind of people, the type of people, you know, we frequently hear that, oh, we need doctors, we need lawyers, we need business people. We have lots of doctors and lawyers and business people in Austin already, and we're still not, you know, moving the needle on some of those issues. It's really hard for someone that doesn't have that kind of a background to get into political office. And normally, their motivation isn't to make a career out of it. They can't put their thumb down on legislation or whatever that benefits their business or benefits their industry or, you know, whatever their livelihood is. If they're, you know, a regular average person just trying to contribute,
but they're
out of the system.
A lot of people have no clue what it costs to run in pretty much any race. And I know, Steve, you know, when you ran, you know, I asked you about how much, and I know I've asked a few other, and it's insane. Like, the average Joe, we're kidding ourselves if we think that that's an option. So
Amy, do you think the lobbyists are, you know, too powerful right now in Austin and really controlling the dial? I mean, if you look up, probably when you start running, whenever you're running against Matt Shaheen, you're going to see all these different real estate companies and all these lobbyists that are piling on the money. So how would you try and eliminate that or low?
What would you like to do? I think we need to have transparency. I think we need to know who's donating the money clearly. I think we have to, as much as we can, have campaign finance reform. But I think it's, you know, it's important for everybody to be involved. And, you know, it's going to take all kinds of people. I know, you know, they say there's no Democratic doctors right now. There's all Republican doctors. So there's really no voice on the other side of the
table. It's only red doctors.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they don't care about
health care. Well, they care about health care, but, you know, there hasn't been any movement on health care, so let's just put it that way. You know, there's been actually some good legislation, but we're not seeing access. We're not seeing the things that I think Democratic values that are being put forward. So I think we need that balance, and I think it takes all kinds of people. I don't think you have to be a doctor or a lawyer, but I think we need a combination. We need the different perspectives, and that's what's going to be important in the long run.
Okay, and Sharon, I was going to bring up Proposition 4. So that constitutional amendment that just went through recently, are you for the constitutional amendment on banning personal state income tax? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it really didn't make it didn't ban a state income tax. It just made it made it harder
to change.
This is how I feel about the income tax, and I'm not proposing an income tax at all. But I don't think you take any option off the table like that. The difference between we have high property taxes and sales tax because those are the two primary sources of revenue. So they're not going to work real hard to diminish those revenue streams. That's why the proposition to raise the sales tax 16%. You know, that really hurts the average person who doesn't have a lot of money in their pocket. an income tax, again, not promoting an income tax, is based on your ability to pay, right? Low wages, low taxes, high wages, supposed to be high taxes. Your home, you could have a $300,000 home or a $400,000 home and lose your job. Your tax liability is not going away because you lost your job. Or you used to make $100,000 a year and now the new job you have, you make $50,000 a year. You know, your option is to move out of your home, right? So I just, my opposition to it was really more of a political thing. It wasn't necessary. It's already difficult. There's really nobody proposing it. There was nobody out there saying, yes, we need to have an income tax. So it was more of a political thing to say, to toot your horn and say, I stopped, you know, any movement on an income tax moving forward.
And Amy, what do you think about the tax prop for?
I think it was short-sighted. We don't know what the future is. I'm not proposing that we
have to say that over
exactly.
And over again.
We're not proposing an income tax. But, you know, you don't know what we're going to need in Texas. We don't know how the industries are going to change, how the revenues are going to change. And now, you know, that really puts up an obstacle that, you know, we couldn't go that route if we needed to. And sales taxes are regressive. And, you know, property taxes are high. So there are a lot of limitations in where we can tax. But I think, you know, we don't know what we're going to need in the future. So I think it makes it a little short-sighted.
And I'll parlay that into appraisal districts. What's your opinion on appraisal districts with regarding these taxes? So
regarding the, I'm sorry, say that again?
So appraisal districts is, at least when we had... with the Republicans we were talking about?
You're expecting me to remember. I just remember the conversation.
The conversation
where
appraisal
they need
districts.
To go away. And actually, I just remembered who, but I'm not going to say
that. So about, you know, should it be reformed to appraisal districts? Because, you know, as Sharon just pointed out, you know, you could lose your income, but the appraisal district determines what your house is. And then it all becomes fungible of what can be used or not used. So do you have an opinion on the appraisal districts if you would do something about the present manner in which they perform?
Well, I think it has to be transparent, and I think that you have to appraise property value if that's how we're going to tax it. I don't know any other way to do that, but it has to be fair. You know, we have to have a transparent process, and there has to be ways that we can account for, you know, other changes that I don't know how we would get away from appraisal districts if that's how we're going to tax, you know, and create revenue.
And Sharon, do you have any comments?
And usually the home is your biggest asset, and so it's not like you want it to be valued low. I know I just recently sold my house, right? And
did you downsize?
Well, kind of. But I'm trying to get rid of things, you know, and just readjust my life for the future. But I sold it for a whole heck of a lot more than what I bought it for. And that was good for me, right? It's tough for young families buying my home. You know, it's difficult for most young families moving into and we had a single-story home, no swimming pool, in Plano, but close to a school, so it was in a nice neighborhood, but still unaffordable for young people. So I don't see that as the housing of the future for people coming up.
Right. And so let's go right into... like gun control, since the state does have some options they can do as far as, you know, concealed handgun or what's your feeling on that, Sharon, about the present gun control that's in Austin, the policies that they have? How would you, you know, react to what's going on now, and how would you make changes, if any?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it a little bit tragic that after all the things that have happened in Texas, we left the last session with, I think, 8 to 10 bills that actually loosened gun regulations, made it easier to possess and have firearms. The people that I'm talking to again at the door, very, very concerned about it. And so the common ground.
There you go, I like that.
Yay,
Sharon!
Are the two universal background checks, making sure you take all the loopholes out of that, and the extreme risk protection laws, the red flag laws. These are not permanently taking anyone's guns away. Again, no one on our side of the aisle that I know of is saying take anybody's guns away. But if you know somebody, because, you know, a large part of these gun deaths are suicide. So get these guns out of the hands of people who are struggling and may hurt themselves or others. And then you want to make sure you want to lessen this domestic violence problem.
So would you increase the age requirement for guns? Is that one of the things that you would propose?
It's
18
now. 18 now. That's awfully young to have a firearm, I think.
So you would.
So I would be in favor, I think, of raising that. But it's hard when you look at the age for things, because we send, you know, young men and women into battle at that age. And then we say, but, you know, you can't vape or smoke or drink or whatever it is, you know, until you're 21.
Right.
And so, you know, what is the age of adulthood? You know, we don't really know. As
well, actually, that new legislation included service people. If you were going to join the service, you actually can buy vape and cigarettes. I thought that was I thought that was interesting that they added that piece in there. So why couldn't we do that with guns?
Yeah, and if my response to that really is, if we are wanting to regulate vaping because it's really harmful to these people, why are we doing that for military?
I don't know. I didn't write it.
I think the age thing.
Why would anyone start smoking in the first place?
But the age thing, I think, really is difficult to determine what age. You know, everybody matures at a different time. But the two, the background checks and the red flag laws, I think, are the starting point.
Yeah, and if our audience wants to listen to a previous show, we had a great show on vaping and talked about that. And in fact, the manufacturers of the vaping materials actually wanted a higher age. They didn't want younger kids to have it. It's a good show if you want to check
actually,
it out.
Actually, yeah. Well, I'd go on and on about that subject. Sorry.
They have to stop flavoring it.
Yeah.
Oh, y'all know we need to move on. I'll just get going and never shut up.
Don't
look at me like that. I'm getting the ugly eye.
Okay, let's talk about another topic that's come up on other shows, which I think is relevant to Austin, is the criminal justice system and social injustice that sometimes some potential candidates are brought up. What's your feeling on that, Amy, as far as the way the state is handling the criminal justice system?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that was brought to me, you know, during this campaign was that children with, you know, autism, other kind of disorders, although they are, that's made a label in the education system, that is not made in the criminal justice system. And there has to be some communication so that when officers are responding to a situation that might involve somebody who has behavioral issues or cognitive issues, that they're aware of the situation ahead of time and that it doesn't escalate to something that would cause injury to either the officer or the person involved. And so I think we can find ways to take that language from the education code to the criminal justice code.
Sharon?
Yeah, that's really a good point. Actually, I think, I don't know if it's in Dallas, but I've heard of one police department that's sending out teams of people on some of these calls if there's a mental health issue or something like that, where it's probably not criminal intent, but they're sending out teams like a plainclothes police officer, a social worker, you know, teams that can better assess the situation. Not to use restrictive tools, you know, to restrain these folks. So that's one thing, and I think we should always be focused on rehabilitation, keeping families together, not putting people in jail for small amounts of marijuana, not putting people in jail for long periods of time because they can't pay bail, you know, ending cash bail, some of those things to further justice.
What does that look like? Because I've read that a lot, you know, lately, because I know the justice system is, you know, being looked at pretty heavy right now. What does that look like, though? What's to deter someone from not committing crimes? I mean, I live pretty honestly. I'm pretty boring. I don't break
laws. Very boring.
No, that's not true. I speed. For real.
Don't speed.
But I've just been reading it a lot.
Did you roll to a stop sign once?
Oh, yeah. Well, no. Anyway, so what does that look like? Because then what would we put in place to deter people from just saying, oh, well, I'll just do this little thing because technically I'm not really going to serve a lot of time because I can't afford it anyway. Mm-hmm. Help me connect some dots with that. I don't understand.
I mean, I don't know how much of a deterrent it is for minor crimes, one thing, but I think the issue really is that people with lower incomes can't post bail, or some of the higher income, even if they did the same crime, can. And so lower economic status is causing those people to be incarcerated for longer periods of time. It's not an equal system.
Well, increase the bail for the rich person. Don't let one out, not the other. Make it hard for both. I mean, I'm not going to pretend like our justice system doesn't have some people sitting in jail that, quite honestly, probably shouldn't be there. But, you know, I have kids, and I teach them, you choose the action, you choose the consequence. If we're going to kind of change the consequence, then how does that impact the action, I guess, is what I'd...
Yeah, and I think logistically, though, you can't incarcerate everybody. That would just increase the cost of the jail system and the prison system, and that's really not the best alternative.
Well, and it's expensive.
It's expensive, right. And it's probably not going to be that beneficial in the long run. So I think that's something that's going to be difficult to tackle, is how do you deter someone, but at the same time, we don't want to fill our jails with the people who can be rehabilitated, who can't have a chance
maybe make options outside of a jail to serve your consequence.
I don't think the answer is no consequence. I think the answer is the consequence doesn't have to be jail, because the system is not fair.
Right.
You know, white collar criminals are not being thrown into a jail for
they can afford nice attorneys.
Right. Yeah. And they also evade the justice system a lot more. So it's tilted in favor of those that have, and it's tilted against people of color and poor people.
So how would we fix that in Austin? Like, we could say it, but what do we do about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of this is local. A lot of the problems are local, but they can be assisted by programs or, you know, laws passed in Austin. I'm not sure if a no cash bail thing is a local issue or a state issue, and in all honesty, I don't know that. But the combination of both those things, because what happens in local communities, it's different. If you're talking about something going on in a little rural town, a crime may be handled much differently than it is in a large municipality, or the crime in a large municipality might rise to a level where we're going to take care of these big things, and these little things we're going to deal with maybe outside of the jail system.
Okay, and another topic that's come up, I'll bring up, is legalization of marijuana for the state of Texas.
One of my favorite.
Is that because you...
Nope, never puffed a cigarette, friends.
Just relax.
It just makes me crazy. There's a lot of money to be made in hemp in the state of Texas.
Oh, hemp's another thing, right?
Yeah, we need... Yeah. Oh.
So, getting back to the question, Sharon, what is your position on legalizing marijuana, whether it be medicinal or recreational or neither or both?
Yeah, well, we have some medicinal already, and we didn't go far enough with that. So, again, if you want to look at the baby steps that we can make, depending on what the makeup is in Austin, you know, sometimes we have to take baby steps. But obviously expanding that, decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana, full legalization, I support as well.
And Amy, what's your position on that?
Well, you know, I think, you know, there were some steps with the compassionate care program to allow, you know, CBD products for patients with epilepsy, you know, my patients with degenerative disorders who don't have other options for basically
medicinal part, yeah. Sure.
So I think that was an important step. As far as legalizing marijuana, I'm kind of on the fence on that one, because I'd like to see more research. Unfortunately, it's been controlled, you know, from the federal level, so there hasn't been much research in the United States.
Right, but we do have, you know, Colorado and, what, Oregon, now Illinois, I think New York.
It's 11 states, I think.
Is 11, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's something that's going to definitely hit the next session. So that's why I was curious on your positions on that. So I do have another question. So you're elected in... I know, unfortunately, maybe for you, the Democrats don't take the House, and you're the minority party. What do you do now to get some of your ideas? How are you going to reach across the aisle to convince some of your Republican counterparts to follow you? I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I would say, you know, even if we do retake the House, you know, the Senate is still likely to be Republican. The governor is going to be Republican, so we're going to have to reach across the aisle either way. And in Texas, you know, historically, we did, you know. Bob Bullock and George Bush worked together, you know, Pete Laney and Rick Perry worked together, and that's how things were done. And so I think we just have to get back to those roots where we, you know, we find issues that are bipartisan that we can agree on and try to get legislation pushed through.
But, and maybe actually compromise on something, right?
Yeah.
Find common ground.
Well, you know, One of the things I think we have to think about is the greater good of our state. And I think if we all stay focused on that on both sides, then we're going to be able to accomplish more in the long run.
And Sharon, how would...
Such a novel idea.
I know.
Sharon, how would you reach across the aisle? Is this similar, or would you do something different?
The best solutions are always going to be bipartisan solutions, because we've seen this happen where if you're too entrenched on your side and you get something, and then the next side is in control and they just unravel
swing
it.
Swing of the pendulum.
I think it's really hard for the general public. I know that that's what's happened in education. I know I was working in a school in 2011 when $5.4 billion was cut from our public schools, and it had huge and devastating impact. So when you see those big pendulum swings, it has such adverse effects on the community and your constituents. So you just can't dig in your heels.
Yeah, the divisiveness, I think, is just, you know, not only on the state level, but of course on the national level. You know, I think that we have to all realize that we all have a common ground, and we all can debate and compromise and come to something. It doesn't always have to be bi-party. I think, you know, that's the unfortunate thing that's going on everywhere right now is, oh, what team are you on? Oh, no, I can't talk to you, or I'm not going to try and compromise. I'm going to stick my feet in the mud and not move. And I think that's something we all have to get around.
It's not sustainable.
Well, I think you can't see, you know, right now people see compromise as failure. And if we continue to see it that way, nothing's going to change. You know, we have to be willing to see compromise as a successful way of moving things in Texas.
All right, and I had a couple more issues, but it's time for us to close down the show. I know Sherry's really sad today. I don't know why, but
no, I'm not.
No, you seem that way. I don't know why. You know what's going on. We'll talk after the show, but
maybe it's the weather.
Maybe.
Maybe.
So I'll give each one of you about a minute or so, just to give a summary of who you are, where people can learn about you, and then, you know, one or two differences between you and your opponent. We talked about it briefly, but you may want to close. So, Amy, you'll go first, and Sharon, you'll end the show.
All right.
Well, again, my name is Dr. Amy Garza Lopez, and I'm running for the Democratic nomination for HD 66. You know, my background, again, is I'm a physician. I'm a mother with school-aged children, and I'm a small business owner. You know, I've dedicated my life to medicine and healthcare, but I'm looking to do more, and I want to have a bigger voice for my constituents, for my community, and for my children. And those are the things that inspire me to be active and to get involved. You can go to my website, texashouserace.com, or you can follow me on social media. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys today and tell you a little bit about myself, because often on the campaign trail, we don't get to tell who we are.
Exactly.
In more than a minute.
That's what we're here
that's
for.
That's why we like our show. It's just like...
Oh, kumbaya moment.
Now I'm saying it gives the audience to see them more as
it's
a person.
Right.
Instead of just the other person across the other person. Anyway, sorry, Amy, I didn't mean it.
No, you're fine. Thank you.
And Sharon?
Sure. I am Sharon Hirsch. I am running to build on the progress that we made last cycle in House District 66 and to deliver new leadership to Collin County in 2020. I am incredibly proud of the legacy of service to my community. I'm going to use those relationships and that service to be a good leader for the district and for the county and for the state. I think together we're better, and we're going to solve the problems that Texas has. And I look forward to your support and your vote if you're voting in the Democratic primary. And you can find more about me at Sharon4TX.com, SharonForTexas.com, website, Facebook, and Twitter. And thank you for the opportunity.
Well, it was great having you here today. And an audience, please go out, most importantly, and vote in your primaries. It's really important to show not only your party, but the fellow community that you're going to be active
in. Talk to your friends about voting also.
Like, yeah, everybody should. We love when people vote. So two great candidates here, Sharon Hirsch, Amy Garza Lopez. Thank you so much for joining us today. So do we have a commitment from whoever wins to join us against, come on the show with Matt Shaheen if he decides to come on? We'll get you back on.
Absolutely.
Sure.
All right. Well, you heard it here. We'll come back on. So thank you so much, everybody. For Sherry Salas, I'm Steve Noskin. Hope you enjoyed the show. Take care and God bless.